30 years. Your voice, your morning. John McKenzie's morning. Only on 4CA 846.
This is interesting, you know. I can't remember how many months ago, but it is many months ago. I had a call from the former head of the Army, Lieutenant General John Gray, about the, well, the sabre rattling over the South China Sea. It was basically just starting to attract a bit of attention, but not much. Well, today it's right across page one of the Australian newspaper. It's everywhere. It says the Philippines last night won its high-stakes case against Beijing's claim of sovereignty over the South China Sea, fueling tensions in Southeast Asia and posing the first diplomatic challenge for a returned Turnbull government. It goes on to say the Permanent Court of Arbitration in The Hague ruled there's no legal basis for China to claim historic rights within the areas falling within the nine-dash line, a demarcation imposed by the deposed Kuomintang regime back in 1947. I mean, this is bizarre. It's had that status since 1947 and hasn't been officially challenged. Well, it has now, and it's absolutely meaningless, according to this body in The Hague. It goes on to say the area is rich in energy, mineral and fishing resources. A third of the world's shipping passed through there. I won't go on with the details because John has pointed out all of this information in the past. Look, the Hague ruling is critically important as far as world opinion is concerned, as far as China's opinion is concerned. They couldn't care less. There's a level of arrogance emerging there in China that's frightening the daylights out of people worldwide. John Gray's with me in the studio. John, good morning.
Hey, good morning,
probably
John.
Probably no surprises for you with that outcome in The Hague.
No, there weren't. I think that there's some pretty interesting things that have come out of the ruling. There are about 15 points put by the Philippines to the court, and they've ruled on 7 of the 15 points. Now, the first ruling was that fishermen from the Philippines and China both have fishing rights around the disputed Scarborough Shoal area, and China had interfered with the restricting process, so there was a criticism of China there. China had destroyed evidence of the natural condition of features in the South China Sea that form part of the dispute. So that's another one peg against China. And the transient use of features above water did not constitute inhabitation, one of the key conditions for claiming land rights of 200 nautical miles rather than 12 miles granted for reefs. So this is pretty interesting. So there's a criticism, and of course China had ratified the treaty, so in terms of international law, it is expected to respect the decision of the court, which it said it won't do. So this is really important in terms of understanding international relations.
They can simply say that we won't accept these rulings. They can just turn their back on this highly respected body. I mean, can nations, and particularly of the dimensions, the size, the influence, the power of China, they can do that in this modern day?
Well, I think you can, but and we've seen it happen with other nations before where they decide to ignore something, but it has ramifications for them in terms of their international standing. Mm. Obviously, China sees the US as being heavily involved in this because of its relationship with the Philippines. Yeah. And in fact, in the US, one of their more right-wing papers, the Global Times, was calling for the US to prepare for military confrontation. Now, what people are trying to do, and other nations are trying to do with ASEAN, is to hose this down a bit and say, let's look at what the court has said, let's discuss this with China, let's not try and isolate China, but have a dialogue, and let's make sure that there aren't any military accidents. Mm. On the other hand, countries like Australia, with our trade going through the area, need China to respect the laws of the sea, the international law. And there will be, I think, moves to demonstrate that they cannot stop international trade going through those waters and that they cannot impose overflight restrictions in international airspace. And China, I think, will try and demonstrate its determination to seize these assets to the extent it can, and that's where the risks come in.
Exactly. There is no way of convincing China of, well, the seriousness of their position without military confrontation.
Yeah, that's right. And if you look at it, we were looking at what happens with rocks, reefs or islands, because that's what China's been doing. It's been getting a rock or a reef and building up on it.
Yeah.
And what the court said was that with low tide elevations or reefs, which are visible only at low tide,
right,
there are no territorial waters for okay. those reefs.
Okay.
It says for rocks which are defined as anything above water at high tide, regardless of size, they get a 12 nautical mile limit of water around them. And an island, though, which is able to sustain human habitation or an economic life of its own, mm-hmm. is given 200 nautical mile exclusion zone. So I think what will happen is that the Chinese government will seize on that third point and say they now have islands which can sustain human habitation, and they want a 200 nautical mile economic zone around them.
Because they've created islands out of nothing at all.
Correct, and they've put, they have put landing strips on them. They have also added habitation on them. So this third dot point of what is the difference in terms of this court ruling, I think is quite significant.
Mm.
Now, what it's all about, that 200-mile zone around those islands then gives you access to the undersea resources. Mm. And that's what the fight is all about, undersea resources, which, of course, other countries such as the Philippines, such as Vietnam, Brunei, et cetera, are all interested in trying to sort out and lay claim to at least some of those resources.
Do you know there's another frightening aspect to this growing crisis too, and that's the outcome in that election in Japan. Shinzo Abe now controls over two-thirds of the Diet. He's got a situation where now he's in a position to be able to actually step up military hardware, if you like, the level of military hardware that Japan can actually have as part of their self-defense forces. They're still going to call it self-defense, but the reality is they will be more potent. Now, already you've got this growing friction between China and Japan. What does that win by Shinzo Abe translate to in the, well, midterm, if you like, as far as the hostility between China and Japan is concerned?
I think China will be very wary of it, and that there will be a lot of rhetoric about it. But in fact, in one sense, for China, it perhaps helps them, because the more that Japan is able to look after itself, the less likely America is to come to the assistance of Japan. And of course, the Americans guarantee Japan's security, and they've also got a treaty, of course, with the Philippines. So if Japan becomes more capable, and they are already very capable, but if they become more capable, that places less reliance on the United States. Now, the United States, I think, will encourage that. So that's, again, something to watch with interest. When I did an official visit years ago to the Japanese Self-Defense Force, I looked at their capabilities and I listened to their strategic outlook. And their strategic outlook mirrored Australia's strategic outlook precisely.
Mm.
So I think they're a trading partner of ours. We are increasing our cooperation with Japan. I don't think we in Australia ought to be overly concerned about that, but we ought to think that there may be some benefits in Japan beefing up its resources.
So you're saying it's better to see Japan at last carrying its weight rather than see this move as a threat to our security, which a lot of older Australians might see it as.
Yes, I don't see Japan as any threat to Australia's security whatsoever. The only reason that we would be concerned about what Japan was doing is because as a trading partner and as an ally these days, and they were our ally in World War One as well, then you've got to remember that there can be concerns if Japan is feeling very threatened. So it really is a time for sensible dialogue, and I hope that later in this month, when the ASEAN states meet, that we'll get a communique out of that. On the other hand, it's quite possible there'll be no communique about the South China Sea because of pressure applied to a couple of the countries, Cambodia and Laos in particular, by China. And China does that through providing Laos and Cambodia with money.
John, I've got to say this, and it's a little bit off the track of what we're saying. As far as the image of China, and for that matter, the Chinese is concerned, this is not good public relations. These jingoistic, you know, cruise liner tours down through the South China Sea where they all stand on deck and sing the Chinese national anthem, etc. This is not good for the image of that country and that country's people.
Well, that's true, but we're seeing it from an external point of view. From a domestic point of view, what they're doing is trying to increase nationalism within China itself and ensure that the more affluent Chinese population, as it sees China emerging more constructively into world affairs, they want to see that China has a voice. So what they're doing is domestically, they're trying to increase nationalism and say, look what the government's doing for you. This is what we are, a great country, and we won't be bullied. On the other hand, they are taking a very bullying approach in UN and international relationships. So what we've got to do, I think, is find a compromise out of this. And the sort of compromises will come from foreign governments talking to China, keeping dialogue going. And let's not forget that the Chinese tourism is very important to Cairns.
Well, precisely.
And the last thing we want to see is a very hostile approach by an Australian government to China, which would then start switching off tourism.
Mm.
So we've got to find a way through this,
yes.
And it's a case of cool heads, but above all, make sure there aren't any military accidents.
Well, how do you ensure that?
Very difficult. You've got to have very careful rules of engagement. You've got to ensure that the US, Japan, the Philippines and China, and more recently Indonesia with some of its confrontation with China about fishing rights.
Yes.
All of those countries pull back a bit and say, let's put sensible rules in place. Let's separate these forces, but allow free trade and free transit, and that's what's got to happen.
It'll be out of the question, I presume, to put together a committee of representatives from every one of those countries that were required to meet every 6 months or whatever, wouldn't it?
Probably. You've got ASEAN that meets regularly. You've got the UN...
They're split down the middle now over this matter.
Well, they are. And the UN Security Council, of course, has Russia and China on it, so with a power of veto. So the present committees that could look at something like that, if they were going to do it, I think they would need to do it under UN auspices.
I see.
And so you would need to try and establish that, I believe, through the UN Security Council.
John, this has been fascinating as always, and thanks for coming into the studio today.
Pleasure, John.
Former head of the Australian Army, Lieutenant General John Gray. We're taking talk